to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As the end of April approaches, many of us welcome not only the return of spring, but also of another season of America's favorite pastime, baseball. The opening of the 2006 season, however, was preceded by the announcement that players from the Negro Leagues had been selected for induction into the National Baseball Hall of Fame, reminding us that such a segregated league existed not all that long ago. Our guest this week, Neil Langto, has written a history of the Negro Leagues, and he'll be discussing his book with Talking History's Eileen Dugan. Following that, Fiona Beattie will tell us about a museum devoted to the Negro Leagues. And after that, in a change of pace, Samuel Walker will offer us his thoughts on the question, who has been the worst American president on civil liberties? But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news, all dealing with race. On a hot September evening in 1906, Atlanta experienced one of the worst race riots in the city's history. For 4 days, white mobs attacked blacks in a fit of hysteria over what turned out to be exaggerated and erroneous reports of sex crimes against white women. Then blacks started fighting back. When the dust settled, at least 24 people were dead, and Atlanta's reputation as a paragon of New South moderation had taken a beating in the eyes of the world. It's a tragic incident the city long sought to forget, but now, 100 years later, a group of Atlantans intends to commemorate the riot and to learn from it. The Coalition to Remember the 1906 Atlanta Race Riot has begun a series of events intended to recall the riot, leading up to the opening of an exhibition at the Martin Luther King National Historic Site next month and a symposium at Georgia State University in September. Organizers say they aren't trying to shame Atlanta, they just want to deal with a significant but largely forgotten chapter of its past. Moving ahead in time, recently released government documents reveal that British troops were told to show respect for the U.S. Army's racial segregation practices during World War II. Black British troops, most from colonial outposts, shared facilities with their white counterparts, but black American soldiers ate and slept separately from their white comrades. The cabinet meeting records show that British officials were eager to avoid clashes in protocol between Allied forces, but they were also unwilling to cause friction among British troops by segregating their own barracks and canteens. In October 1942, Churchill told the cabinet that the views of the United States must be considered. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, at the end of February, a committee of baseball historians elected 17 people to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Featured among the group were 7 Negro League players, 5 pre-Negro League players, 4 Negro League executives, including the first woman to be elected to the hall, and 1 pre-Negro League's executive. The group will be inducted in July in Cooperstown, but while we await that historic event, let's turn to our guest this week, Neil Langto, who will give us some history of Negro Leagues baseball. You're listening to Talking History.
Thank you.
As a new baseball season begins, the planned induction of the latest group of electees to the National Baseball Hall of Fame has drawn our thoughts to a day when black players of the sport played in segregated leagues. Our guest this week has written a history of the Negro Leagues, and he'll be interviewed by Talking History's Eileen Dugan.
Each summer, we are reminded again of the story of Jackie Robinson's historic signing with the Brooklyn Dodgers and how that began to open the door to African Americans playing Major League Baseball. But what of the league from which Robinson and others had come? We have come to know of some of the personalities of black baseball, the Satchel Paiges, the Josh Gibsons, but until now we have known but little about Negro League baseball as an institution. Thanks to one recent book, the workings of the Negro League have finally been revealed. With us today is Dr. Neil Langto of the University of Delaware. Dr. Langto is the author of a must-read book for any baseball fan, Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution. Welcome, Dr. Langto.
Thank you.
How does your book differ from those of the past in terms of your approach to the subject and the sources you took?
Well, I think one thing I tried to do was get away from the player-oriented analysis. There have been a lot of books about the Negro Leagues, but many of them have focused on the players and their exploits, which are very interesting in and of themselves, but I think that had been done. And what I wanted to look at in this book was look at the business end and look at it as an institution and an African-American business and how it operated for so many years. What I think I did differently here, I tried to look at basically everything I could on the Negro Leagues, read every newspaper, every African-American newspaper, and then from there look at some of the other records, the court records, the federal records, and some of the papers that the teams themselves left behind, which unfortunately we don't have a whole lot of.
In what cities were the first Negro League teams established?
Well, Negro League teams were usually established in areas where you had large African-American populations in the Midwest, the East, and the Upper South. Some in the South as well, but the South was usually not as favorable for African-American baseball because of the interracial issue. You could not have interracial games there. And a lot of the Negro League teams survived during the week playing non-league games against white opponents. So the early Negro League teams were established typically in Chicago and New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, places like that, which had big enough black populations that could support a black institution like this.
How did that correspond to black migration rates in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, the first Negro League was started in 1920, and that was exactly the period where the Great Migration, well, it was winding down, the first wave of the Great Migration. But that's when you had tremendous numbers of African Americans moving from the South to the North and creating these urban ghettos, very sizable black communities of like 100 to 200, 300,000 people. You had a city within the city, which enabled you to create separate black businesses, which were created, of course, in response to discrimination and segregation in these cities.
Who ran the Negro League teams?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, a lot of different people were involved, both African American and white. You had some women involved as well. In my book, I talk a lot about Effa Manley, who was actually a white woman who passed as a black woman. It's a very interesting story, whose husband had owned one of the teams, but she herself was very much involved in the running of the New York Eagles for a number of years. During the period in my book, which is mostly the 30s to the 50s, you had a lot of numbers bankers. These were men who ran the illegal numbers lottery in the black community, which was a very accepted business in the black community because often these gentlemen gave back to the black community. So they were seen as somewhat of a victimless crime. And a lot of these men had money during the Depression when not many people had money at all, and they were able to sink some of their profits into running Negro League teams. The most prominent is Gus Greenlee, who I talk a lot about in my book. He basically saved the Negro Leagues in the 1930s with his sizable wallet.
What did whites have to do with black baseball?
Well, there were some white owners. There were some white owners of the teams, and that was always sort of controversial. Some people felt this was an African-American business and should be, in fact, run by African-Americans. There were some white promoters who did a lot of booking of the teams. You know, as I mentioned before, when they played the league games with other Negro League teams, usually on the weekends and maybe a game during the week, but in between they played a lot of games against white semi-professional teams. And those were booked by white promoters, and there was some controversy about their take of that. But on the other hand, there were some white owners who took care of the players very well, took care of the teams very well, particularly the Kansas City Monarchs, whose owners, J.L. Wilkinson and Tom Baird, really ran their club very well. And most of the black players who played for them felt that they were very well treated. But it differed from city to city and team to team, certainly.
What was the impact of the Depression upon black baseball?
Well, the Depression really dealt a sledgehammer blow to almost every kind of amusement, you know, be it the movies or professional baseball, at least in the early 30s. And the Negro Leagues were no exception, particularly because the black community itself was so fragile. I mean, they were always the last to be hired and the first to be fired. So you had catastrophic unemployment rates in the black community. So it was really difficult to operate any kind of black institution or black business during the 1930s. And that's what's so remarkable about the Negro League surviving. I mean, there was a review of my book and some reviewers said that Gus Greenlee trying to start the Negro Leagues anew in 1933 was either a stroke of genius or it was an act of madness, basically, because of the economic situation was so fraught with difficulty at the time.
What was the role of the All-Star Game in the survival of black baseball?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, each year in the Negro Leagues, they have what was called the East-West Game, which actually started the same year as the Major League All-Star Game, 1933. And the East-West Game was played between the best players of the Eastern Negro Leagues and what they called the West, which was basically the Midwestern Negro Leagues. And this was played each year in Comiskey Park in Chicago, and it drew a huge number of fans. And by the 40s, they were drawing 50,000 fans for this, which was really remarkable. It was remarkable also because it was a showcase for some of the best black talent. And it also got a lot of coverage from not only the African-American newspapers, but from the white newspapers as well that would actually give some coverage to this and actually alert some white fans to the existence of some very, very talented black players who were not getting their due.
What kinds of administrative problems plague the Negro League?
Well, that's really a theme of my book. Ultimately, the Negro League suffered very much from the administrative difficulties within the organization. The problem was, I think, was the owners themselves could seldom act collectively. They were very much out for themselves, which is really not surprising. That's the nature of sports. You know, team owners are out for themselves, but you have to achieve a balance, you know, what's good for the league also. And the Negro Leagues were never quite able to get that. So you had owners who typically wanted to do what was best for them, and if the league suffered, that was okay. So you had basic problems with things like compiling statistics, not able to get a consensus on the leagues as far as good statistics keeping. You had problems with contracts. Some owners kept very good contracts with their players. Others didn't want to use contracts for various reasons. You know, there was just a lot of sloppy administrative work. There just was never a strong authority figure. And I think they came to regret that when integration occurred. I mean, they tried to fix some of their problems in the mid-40s, but at that point, the cat was out of the hat. Integration had occurred, and the major leagues were already starting to pick players away from the Negro Leagues, and the Negro League teams were not getting compensated like they had hoped to. And part of the reason was because of the administrative issues that had not been taken care of prior to this point.
What was it like to play for a team?
Well, it depended where you played. You know, if you happened to be based in the South, and as I said, there were some franchises in the South, Birmingham and Memphis, you had a lot of travel, you know, a tremendous amount of travel from team to team. The Eastern teams, however, particularly the team in Philadelphia where I'm located, didn't travel as much because they were centrally located. The Philadelphia teams in the 30s and 40s often just traveled as far as New York or the Upper South. So the Eastern League was much more compact, although in the later days of the Negro Leagues, all the teams were traveling all over because the venues weren't paying off anyone. They had to go all over the place. The Midwestern teams tended to travel more because the franchises were more distantly located and not as compact. So there was a good deal of travel involved in the league. Usually the players would play from almost April to October every day against a variety of competition, as I mentioned, maybe 60, 70 games a year against Negro League teams and the others against white semi-professional teams. Usually the pay was, I would say, comparable to mid-minor league level pay. By the 40s, they were making as much as maybe a AAA player would get, depending on where you were playing. Certainly, they didn't have any of the things that a major league teams had or the minor league teams had as far as lodging and things like that. They stayed at black hotels if they were in the large cities, and sometimes they just traveled from place to place. It was a very hard life, certainly, and if they had the perks that the major leaguers had, they probably would have been even better, and many observers even noted that at the time, that how well they played despite having to play under very harsh conditions from town to town.
When did Negro League baseball reach its peak in popularity and profitability?
I think it was during World War II. I mean, World War II was really a watershed for African Americans in a couple of ways. I mean, economically it was, because during the war, the government needed everything, and we had almost full employment during the war. And African Americans were able to get jobs where they hadn't been able to get jobs for a long time. So I think the average African American fan had a little more money in his pocket during the war. The other thing, too, is that there was great restrictions on travel during the war, so people couldn't travel as much. So the fact that Negro League teams were continuing to play week to week, they were drawing large fans, fans who couldn't go anywhere else, and drawing very well. The Negro League teams during World War II were drawing, I think, 5,000 to 10,000 fans regularly. which may not sound much today, but you have to compare what the major leagues were drawing at that time, and that's not far less than the major leaguers were drawing on a much wider customer base. So they were doing very, very well during World War II, which is kind of ironic because at the same time, you have changes in people's attitudes towards race somewhat brought about by the war. So at the same time they're doing so well economically, people are also questioning segregated institutions and integration is really being pushed more and more. So that's kind of the irony of the whole situation during the war.
How supportive of Negro League baseball was the African-American community?
They were very supportive by and large. I think by the 30s and 40s, there was some frustration. I mean, in my book, I do kind of cover a lot of the attitudes of the black fans, which you can get from the newspapers, just things from letters to the editor. You get the sense of what people felt. There was sometimes frustration that the leagues were not as run as well as they could be. And the reason why was because African-American fans could see the major leagues as a frame of reference. You know, the major leagues were in their face all the time. And they could see how perfectly they were operated. The schedules were perfect and the statistics were perfect. But of course, the major league owners had vastly more money than the Negro Leaguers did. So I think there was occasionally some frustration at the leagues, which was expressed not only by the fans but by the sports writers. But I think in general, both the sports writers, black sports writers and black fans, were very supportive of the leagues while they were going. I think they became less supportive when integration occurred with Jackie Robinson. I think they felt that the leagues had done their job and no longer needed the support and had basically outlived their purpose.
What really was the impact of Jackie Robinson signing upon black baseball?
Well, he signed in October 45, and the effect wasn't that pronounced in 46. In 46, he played in the minor leagues in Montreal, although there were still some rumblings that it was already starting to siphon away some of the gate in the minor league cities where Negro League teams played. But you really see the effect in 47, where just, you know, the black fans and the black newspapers just went gaga over Jackie and were just following his every move. They were turning out by the thousands at the major league parks if they could get to them. And the interest in Negro League baseball, I would say, almost cut in half in 47. The attendance just really just dropped precipitously. And it got worse from year to year. The more major league players that came in, the interest just dropped off. And it's not surprising because of what was going on. In the late 40s, integration was the thing, and African Americans could see tangible progress being made in integration, and Jackie Robinson was very much a reflection of this. And they saw the Negro League as being part of the past, something they didn't necessarily want anymore, and the future seemed to be in the hands of Jackie Robinson and other players who were breaking through.
One last question. What is the legacy of Negro League baseball?
I think the legacy is of this creation of a black institution that lasted for almost 40 years, that provided a place where black talent could be developed and showcased. I think if you don't have the Negro Leagues, you made it, integration might take much longer. The fact that these leagues were able to develop an amazing group of players, and also the fact they were able to develop this business that was very much built on African-Americans, nickels, dimes, and quarters, became a very successful business at a time when few black businesses even could succeed like this. I mean, at its peak, I think Negro League baseball was probably in the top three with the black newspapers and black insurance companies. So it's really a triumph of black enterprise and also of fostering black talent and giving African Americans something to be proud of.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Neil Langto of the University of Delaware, author of Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution.
Welcome back. The Negro Leagues, about which you just heard, has a museum dedicated to its history. Fiona Beatty is here to tell us about it.
In its heyday, the greats of jazz, Charlie Parker, Count Basie, Big Joe Turner, to name but a few, called Kansas City's 18th and Vine District home. It was here, too, in February 1920, that the Negro National League was founded. There were dance halls, nightclubs, restaurants, a thriving black community, and close by, the Muebark Field, home to the Kansas City Monarchs. Some have called the Monarchs the Negro League's answer to the New York Yankees. After all, they won more than a dozen league championships. Beginning in the late 1950s, however, the strains of jazz and aroma of barbecue gave way to a new era, and the area fell silent until 1997, when the historic 18th and Vine District Museum complex opened. Fittingly, the Negro League's Baseball Museum shares space with the American Jazz Museum, making a rewarding one-stop shop for visitors. Although tours are self-guided, visitors to the Baseball Museum follow a directed path. Passing through turnstiles, visitors enter the exhibit area where a timeline of African American and baseball history from the 1860s through the 1960s provides valuable reference points. The exhibits are artifact-rich and in addition include charts, maps, photographs and manuscripts. Two theaters offer a variety of presentations, from a four-minute orientation film, rare footage and interviews with players, to a 15-minute film, They Were All Stars. Arranged around 20 themes, the exhibition explores topics such as the unofficial gentleman's agreement, banning black players from major leagues at the beginning of the 20th century, to the emergence of black teams, night baseball and life on the road. The incomparable Satchel Paige and Jackie Robinson are showcased, but one of the most popular exhibits is the Legends Lockers display. Here, uniforms owned by Negro League players inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame are displayed alongside photographs and biographical information. Finally, visitors follow the tour to the Baseball Diamond and the Field of Legends exhibit, featuring lifelike bronze statues of selected players. To learn more about Negro League's Baseball Museum, go to www.nlbm.com.
And finally, as promised, Samuel Walker joins us to offer some historical perspective on those who have labeled President George W. Bush the worst president ever on civil liberties. Walker is Professor Emeritus of Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He's writing a book on the subject titled An Uncertain Defense, Presidents and Civil Liberties from Wilson to Bush.
President George W. Bush has been assailed by critics for his assaults on civil liberties. His faith-based initiative breaches the wall between church and state. He is strongly opposed to abortion rights and gay and lesbian rights. The Patriot Act threatens freedom of speech and due process. Finally, he has made sweeping claims of presidential powers that many believe go far beyond anything the Constitution permits. But is he the worst president ever on civil liberties, as some critics charge? The question calls for a full review of how American presidents have dealt with civil liberties issues. In fact, the civil liberties records of our presidents from Woodrow Wilson to George W. Bush are filled with surprises, contradictions, and ambiguities. Although Wilson is consistently ranked among the very best presidents, his civil liberties record is one of the very worst. In addition to his assaults on free speech during World War I, he imposed racial segregation among federal employees. Franklin D. Roosevelt, meanwhile, ordered the evacuation and internment of the Japanese American, one of the most shameful episodes in all of American history. But he also appointed great civil libertarians to the Supreme Court, and the Roosevelt Court created the first significant body of constitutional law protecting individual rights. In short, Both liberal Democratic and conservative Republican presidents have been guilty of serious violations of civil liberties. Presidents who were very good on certain issues were bad on other issues. Richard Nixon will be remembered for the abuses of presidential power related to Watergate, but he also established affirmative action as official government policy. Bill Clinton was a strong advocate of abortion rights, but he also sponsored the Communications Decency Act, which was potentially one of the most sweeping peacetime censorship laws in our history. A full consideration of presidents and civil liberties is overdue and serves several purposes. First, it helps put our current president in perspective. Second, it gives us a more complete picture of the performance of previous occupants of the White House. Third, it reminds us again that party affiliation does not necessarily determine how well a president will defend the values of free speech, equality, and due process of law.
You've been listening to Samuel Walker, Professor Emeritus of Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and the author of the forthcoming book, An Uncertain Defense, Presidents and Civil Liberties from Wilson to Bush. Walker's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.